Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here with my man Jason, the co-host whose sense of equality runs so deep that he always insists that women and children go down with the ship. That's very progressive of you, Jason. Yes, I just wanted to compliment you on just your forward-thinking viewpoints on gender, age discrimination, all of that. Yeah. Like that you're willing to sacrifice people to prove a point. That says a lot about you as a person.
Well, you know, equality is the goal here, right?
Yeah. speaking of equality, not all drinks are created equal. Jason, what do you got this week?
Well, I didn't even know we still had any of this left, and I'm just so thrilled to find it. So we had just enough for one last glass of Jefferson's Ocean Aged Bourbon, which is really tasty. It says that it was aged in a, you know, casket at sea or whatever. I have no idea if there's any veracity to that, but you can definitely taste a little salt in it, which I really like.
I think that's timely with this week's topic. I'm on trend for the topic as well. I've got some Kraken rum that I'm going to unleash, just like I'm about to unleash some truth bombs on you and redefine your perceptions of the topic we're going to cover this week.
I think I've mentioned to you before with the Kraken stuff, I actually really like the Kraken rum. Yeah. It's just unusual that you find something that's so aggressively branded. That's actually pretty good. Oh, and then also, you know, because I am two-fisting yet again, as we were setting up for this podcast tonight, I accidentally ended up opening two beers. So technically, I'm drinking a raging truth.
Wait, two beers. So you have two beers and a glass of
And a glass bourbon. Of bourbon. So I'm right. Three-fisting tonight.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll give a shout-out to one of our superest of super fans, Joey. The last time I drank Kraken was with Joey on New Year's Eve. I don't remember much of it, but the videos that I see of it entertain me every time.
I remember the phone call that I got at about 11 o'clock that no one in that house remembers.
That's what New Year's is for. Okay, well, speaking of stupid decisions, we also have to do some housekeeping and talk about stupid things that we got wrong in a previous episode. So that means it's time for
Matt and Jason are stupid.
You suck.
So like I said, we have these in pretty much every episode. It's where we have to go back and clean something up that we got wrong in a previous episode. And this one, I'm the principal offender. I was listening today, actually, to our Are We Living in a Simulation episode. And my worst stupid this week is from our worst stupid from that episode. So I don't know if that cancels out or how that works.
That's really following the rabbit down the rabbit hole. Yeah.
You could have said you could make the case maybe it was a simulated were stupid, like it was a simulation inside a simulation. Go back and catch the episode if you
want. What happens if you take both pills?
Yeah. But anyway, when we were recapping the were stupid in that episode, I said that we hadn't done a they're stupid in a while. That's the version of the show where we have a guest on.
Right.
And we said the most recent they're stupid we had done was with Dr. Aaron. That's not true. The most recent they're stupid we had done was actually with Dr. Rags, and it was the case for cannibalism. So we totally forgot about Dr. Rags. And then when we talked about Dr. Aaron, I said it was the episode The Hobbits Should Have Walked to Mordor. and 75% of that book is dedicated to walking. So what I meant to say was The Hobbits Should Have Flown to Mordor. And I've made my feelings on this topic extremely clear. There's no reason The Hobbits should have been walking anywhere. So I just wanted to clear that up.
No, and you're not completely the only one with blame in that regard, because I should have remembered the Rags episode, because the cannibalism episode is one of my favorite that we've done.
All right. Well, just like that section of the show, many people have called this podcast in general a Titanic disaster. So I figured it was time that we finally got to the bottom of what happened to the Titanic, Jason. And when I say get to the bottom, I'm not necessarily talking about the bottom of the ocean. what do you know, Jason, about the history of the HMS Titanic that you don't know from the James Cameron, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet film?
So I know it was one of two ocean liners that was built by the same company, the White Star Company. I think the first one was the Oceanic, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think it sailed first and was successful in that it made it from one port to another. The Titanic was widely touted as this marvel of modern technology, and this was, you know, right around the turn of the previous century. It turned out to not be quite as marvelous as everybody had anticipated. Had a run-in with an iceberg due to a crew that was probably not as attentive as they probably ought to have been. And the results of that were catastrophic because not only was there hubris on the part of the crew in not paying attention to the icebergs, there was hubris on the part of the designers in that they did not put very many lifeboats on this unsinkable ship, which led to disastrous consequences and most of the passengers dying.
So was it negligence, Jason, or was it design? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. And the question for this week is, stupid or not stupid, none of the narrative that Jason just shared with you listeners is true. It's just part of a cover-up to hide what really happened to the HMS Titanic.
Well, I was giving a very truncated version of my recollection of this topic. I am aware of the design features on the Titanic in that the flood walls basically did not go to the top of where the flooding actually ended up occurring, which is a ridiculous design feature. But I assume we're going to get into that later.
We'll touch all of it. So let's unravel the mystery here. Let's jump in the lifeboat of truth and get to the bottom of this. So most of your summary was right, Jason. The RMS Titanic was a British passenger liner, and you were right. It's the White Star Line. I think you called it something else, but
I said line.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go back and edit it and make you sound like you were wrong.
Perfect.
It was the White Star Line. It allegedly sunk in the North Atlantic Ocean on April 15th, 1912. After, just like you said, striking an iceberg on her maiden voyage, which was taking place from Southampton in the United Kingdom to New York City. There's just over 2,200 people on board, of which 1,500 approximately are purported to have died, which made, at the time, it one of the deadliest single sinkings of a ship up to that time. So in like all of maritime history, and remains to this day the deadliest peacetime sinking of a superliner or cruise ship, which I didn't know, which I found interesting. Yeah. There hasn't been a single greater maritime disaster in a civilian sense since the sinking, alleged sinking.
I don't know. I've heard a lot of these stories about the Carnival cruise lines during coronavirus. But
one of the other things that's worth noting, just kind of around the mystique, the aura of the Titanic story, is on the voyage were some of the wealthiest people in the world.
Yes.
As well as you kind of get the stratification. So you have literally some of the wealthiest people on the planet, and then mixed in with immigrants from Great Britain, Ireland, Scandinavia, places all over Europe who are basically all traveling to the United States.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to go a completely different direction. I thought you were going to say you had all the rich people, and then on the middle decks, you had sort of the middle class, and then in steerage class, you had like all the Italians and the lower class Europeans, and then down in the baggage class as basically just ballast were the Irish, right?
You can only say that because those are your people, Jason.
That's right.
I feel like you can get away with it. And just to drive that point home, I was reading about this one guy who was on the ship, John Jacob Astor.
Yes.
And I'm sure if Dr. Tater Tots was here, he'd tell some crazy story of how he was like a Freemason who bathed in the blood of like Galileo and now can live forever or something.
Well, actually, he did comment on this earlier this evening when he found out that this was the topic.
Of course he did.
Yes. So John J. Astor was, at the time, one of the richest people in the world. And it's interesting that when you think back on that time period, there were a lot of names that everybody knows. People don't really tend to remember him as one of the richest people.
So, yeah, he was estimated at the time. So his net worth at the time in like 1912 dollars was $87 million. So that's the equivalent of $2.3 billion today, which would make him, you know, so far as we could tell. We weren't as good at keeping track of things back then, but right. He was considered to be the wealthiest person in the world. So it's just interesting. It would be like if Jeff Bezos is, I don't know, Hyperloop train derailed and he died or something.
Right. Well, actually, now it would be as though Elon Musk had died in one of his self-driving cars.
Yeah, yes. My bad. You know, it's funny. I don't know where I picked this up too, but there's a scene in the movie Titanic where one of the smokestacks like rips off and falls down and crushes a guy.
Yeah.
And that is, they're not explicit about it and he doesn't have like lines in the film, but that's supposed to be Astor. And according to people who survived and saw Astor die, they say that's how he died.
Right.
Like the stack broke off and crushed him. So it's a cool little throwback, I guess, from the movie.
As all billionaires should die. No.
So that's sort of the narrative, right? So the ship is kind of negligently built, negligently handled. In the middle of the night, strikes an iceberg. Slowly it goes down over time. There's not enough lifeboats on the ship for everyone to be able to pile in and escape, and 1,500 of the 2,200 passengers go into the ocean and freeze to death, right, pretty much, yep, or drowned.
Right. All right. Or so get hit by smokestacks.
Or get hit by, or get hit by smokestacks or shot in the heart by Billy Zane.
Right.
Yeah. Or that's what lamestream history would lead us to believe, Jason. But luckily for us, and luckily for this...
Oh, man. Matt's been doing his own research again.
And luckily for this podcast, there are luminaries out there like Mr. Robin Gardiner and Dan Van Der Vat. Dan Van Der Vat. And man, I hope these guys have Twitter accounts so I can tag them in this episode. But I want everyone to be clear. I'm reading something right now as what I'm about to say. This is their own description of their novels on Amazon. So this is kind of the blurbs they've written for themselves.
Oh, no.
Quote, in the best-selling book, The Riddle of the Titanic, Robert Gardiner and his co-author Dan Van Der Vat shocked the world with their claims that it was not, in fact, the Titanic, but the sister ship, the Olympic, which finished its days amidst the icy waters of the North Atlantic on that fateful night. Now, in his controversial follow-up, Titanic, the Ship That Never Sank, Robin Gardiner goes further into the scandal of the sinking. So this is the premise for the stupid, not stupid question that that we're going to ask is, are Robin and Van Der Vat, are they pseudo-historians? Or are they spitting truth left and right like Dr. Tater Tots? This is what we got to figure out. So let's go over the evidence that they put forward for their theory. And I got to say, Jason, if we're doing unscientific polls, which are the only kind we conduct on this podcast,
right?
I did a quick review of the reviews of their book. I just scrolled through Amazon,
yeah,
and it's like 5-1 in favor of like this book being brilliant. And then like one, it's kind of like the Mort book when we talked about those reviews where like other people were like, what the fuck did I just read?
Right.
Like every 10th person. That was like, people were like, the only solid, one guy was so funny. He said, the only solace that I have from reading this book is that it was a gift and I didn't spend my actual money, my own money on it. So yeah, you either love this theory or you hate it, but let's get in it.
Well, it also brings up a semantic question for us here on the podcast, because you were talking about their evidence being solid. Well, on this show, we know that lack of evidence is evidence,
is evidence
of existence. So does evidence itself constitute a lack of existence?
we're gonna have to check the baseline parameters of the simulation, I think, to answer that question. So you talked about the Olympic sailing first, which is the Titanic's sister ship, which, right, I guess we should from the beginning say these two ships were indistinguishable.
Oh, they were completely,
right,
identical.
They, yeah, were completely identical. Like, you would have to be someone who not just worked on the ship but had like an intimate knowledge of its design or function or potential flaws to be able to spot and pick it out. And even then, you'd have to be looking at the right thing at the right time. Right,
right, right. It was as identical as you could make anything in 1912.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Aside from the paint job, mm-hmm, yeah, almost everything.
And there were some flooring differences too,
right,
I guess. But, and we'll actually get into that. But so in 1911, the Olympic actually, it's not considered its maiden voyage because it wasn't like taking passengers. It was more of like a test voyage. It was just moving between two ports.
I believe it's called a soft opening.
Okay, well, during the Olympics soft opening, it was just off the coast of the Isle of Wight, off the coast of Great Britain, which is coincidentally off the coast of, oh man, what's the micronation that ends up being out there? And I can't remember.
Oh.
There's a great micronation off the coast of the Isle of Wight, too. That's totally escaping
one of
my
the
mind.
Few micronations that has actually gone to war with another
and
nation.
And been,
yeah,
like sovereignly upheld in the, yeah, courts of Great Britain, like its sovereignty has been recognized. So catch our micronations episode if you haven't heard it to figure out what we're talking about. But just off the coast of the Isle of Wight, the Olympic struck the HMS Hawk and caused some pretty significant damage to the Olympic. And this wasn't great for the White Star Line, because it meant that the Olympic was going to be taken out of service while they repaired it. And it also meant that they're going to have to pay out some pretty significant insurance claims because they were at fault in the strike.
Well,
the
they
Hawk.
Just hired the best and brightest,
yeah,
didn't,
right,
they?
Maybe there's a reoccurring theme here. So because
as captain of the boat, you literally have one job.
So because of the incident with the Olympic, that meant that the maiden voyage of the Titanic had to be pushed back from March 20th to April 10th because they had to deal with this situation with the Olympic, getting it into dry dock, trying to get the repairs, having the necessary resources to do everything that they needed to do. Because by all accounts, the White Star Line was actually pretty strapped due to the development of these two ships. And so they were pretty heavily leveraged. It was high risk, high reward. So this is something the White Star Line couldn't really afford to do, the authors theorize, like deal with this delay.
I understand the point that they're making. I would be curious to see the numbers. I bet they're overreaching because that's what, a 2.5-3 week delay?
Right. But
at that time, that's not
time and money of the lifeblood of any business, Jason. And if you're a real competitor, if you're one of these robber barons of the early 1900s, like, you do anything you can for any edge.
Fair enough. I understand that. But I'm just saying 2.5 weeks of paying a standing army cost and iron repair, or a marching army cost and iron repair, that's not a huge stretch of cash for me. That's not going to, unless you are massively over-leveraged.
Well, and you also have to consider, though, now, not only did they have to come up with the money they would have missed out on due to the Olympics damage and being out of service, but they're dealing with this lawsuit, too. So their books were not in a great situation because of this collision with the HMS.
I would also be curious to know how much they were indemnified for this kind of stuff, but I don't know.
You should do your own research, Jason. How about that? So, the authors put forward this theory, and I got to say, it holds water better than the Titanic, because the plan was simple, Jason. We're going to...
everything? Actually, other way around, the Titanic held water really well.
So the scheme here is simple, as schemes go. You got two ships, they look identical to each other. One's damaged and not seaworthy, and the other seems to be operating pretty good. So why not switch them, Jason, and then intentionally dispose of the one that is damaged and claim the insurance money that you leverage on the ship that is worth more and use it to cover the cost of the repairs for the useless ship that you have. So this is the basis of the theory that they put forward. And, like many of the cover-ups, conspiracies, and forgotten avenues of history that we explore on this show, this seems pretty credible to me. So let's go over some of the evidence that the authors have proposed.
Sure.
So, look, we already covered, no one really would have known that we swapped these ships, right? So the people in charge, we probably, not all of these guys will be familiar, but the last one will be to most people. J. Bruce Ismi.
Yeah.
Lord Pyrrhy. I'm sorry, who, did you want to say something on Ismi?
Ismi, he was on the Titanic, was he? Or on what was purported to be the
I don't know if he was, but it gets interesting here. So of these guys who were kind of the lead investors or like the financial masterminds of this venture. So Ismi, Lord Pierre, Andrew Thomas, and JP Morgan. Right. I know for sure that JP Morgan pulls out of the voyage at the last minute. Like JP Morgan is meant to be on the Titanic, him and his whole family. And we'll talk more about that. But the point is only these four guys kind of had the capability in the pool to institute this quote unquote conspiracy that we're going to be talking about. So it's just important that we mention them here at the top. So we're not talking about a large network of conspirators. It's not like some of the things we've talked about previously with tinfoil hat conspiracies in DC, where all these people would have to be involved in a massive cover up.
When
it's
we
just
get to
these
the part
four
where
guys.
I refute all of these claims, I'm actually going to make a very different case, but go right ahead.
Okay, but so far, it's a small group of people, right?
Right.
So enough.
Sure.
We're at a number where people can keep their mouths shut. From conspiracies that you and I have personally participated in with more than four people, we know we can keep stuff quiet.
Actually, it's the fourth one that's usually the problem.
Yeah. Well, that's why we start with four and the conspiracy ends up with three.
That's right.
That's how it usually goes.
And hence why you have all the mulch in your yard.
we'll have to give the backstory on that later. These guys came up with this plan to essentially commit insurance fraud. And I want to point out, just because I've read a couple books related to this, and there was a really good Colin Farrell movie that just came out, or it was like a series, Great White North or The Great North or something. It was essentially a true story where they do this exact same thing with a whaling ship. Like, it wasn't insane and unheard of at this time to intentionally sink ships for the insurance money. Like, this is a standard robber baron scheme.
But you're talking about categorical economic differences between a whaling ship and something.
Right. We're talking two different categories, but this is JP Morgan, man. You just look at things that normal people do and then you do them bigger, right? Like, these guys just thought on bigger scales.
Yeah.
So
no.
it's in the realm of possibility. But so they set this plan in motion and they went about basically changing all of the small, subtle things you'd have to do to make the Olympic look exactly like its sister ship, the Titanic. So they roll out carpet to cover the floors. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is documented in photography of the Titanic, right? So
I am aware of that.
Yeah. So for like at the last minute, all these carpet, like there's documented evidence of like all this carpeting being brought onto the Titanic. And
so a million years ago, we've discussed, you know, this has been an ongoing topic on this podcast mm-hmm. for a very long time that I've worked a stupid number of different crazy jobs. At one point, I actually worked at a video game company that did mm-hmm. a video game about the Titanic, and I spent hundreds of hours looking at all of those photographs of the rooms.
Yep.
Like, basically to make sure that our graphics met that same, like, that they were up to snuff. I may not know that much about the Titanic itself, but I definitely know, like, all the different inlay patterns. And
right. Yeah, and yeah. So, like, these aesthetic things, like, definitely happened. And yeah. then, you know, there's not just pictures of the interior of the Titanic. There's also, obviously, pictures of both the exterior of the Titanic as well as the Olympic. And when you look at pictures of them independently, so, like, we know, like, this picture was taken earlier in the shipyard, and we know this is the Titanic. Right. And you have another picture that you know was taken earlier, and you know this is the Olympic. When the Titanic is pictured being built, it has 14 evenly spaced portholes down the side of the ship when it's leaving port. On the maiden voyage, though, of the Titanic, when we see it leaving port, it has 16 unevenly spaced portholes that you can observe in the photo as it leaves port. And guess how many portholes that the Olympic had, Jason, during its construction that you can see in the same photos? How many do you think it was?
I'm going to say it was 18. 16 unevenly spaced, I assume.
16 unevenly spaced portholes. So, yeah. You know, maybe there's an innocent explanation here, but it is pretty incredible that you see photos of the Titanic during its construction, and there's this one minor kind of design change that, you know, most people at the time wouldn't have been looking for, would ever been obvious to anyone. Only the true internet sleuths of Reddit and Quora have the time and resources with the benefit of hindsight to go back and uncover details like this.
When they're not looking for Q.
Yeah, when they're not looking for Q, they have time to go back and find details like this. But this is absolutely legitimate that we know from the schematics of the Titanic how many portholes it's supposed to have. And then we count those portholes in photos of it leaving port. And it doesn't add up. So, look, I don't want to build a mountain out of a porthole, but maybe this is the first grain of sand in the beachhead we're going to build.
I find it equally likely that what happened is that those were cabins that were like higher dollar cabins, and somebody got pissed off because like someone who was higher up in the company was like, if we're going to be selling these cabins, they need more windows, they need more light. It's not that tough to cut a porthole in the hull of a ship. So yeah, I don't find that like a last minute change. I don't find that shocking at all.
Okay, well, maybe you're right, but it's certainly something to consider, and I'm not asking you to make up your mind, Jason, about the truth of the Titanic based off one piece of evidence. It's the aggregate of all the doubt I'm going to place here, and I think, you know, you'll see it my way by the end. So let's let's keep going. There's also, you know, anecdotal evidence, and this is also hard to verify, so it's circumstantial, but there is anecdotal evidence of members of the, I guess, the dry dock crew who kind of gave credence to this rumor, this theory from the beginning that the ships were being switched. Now, that's just scuttlebutt among the working guys, but there is one letter that the authors got their hands on from a man who lived in Australia who lived in Australia at the time he wrote the letter, but he worked in the shipyards in Great Britain. I'm assuming he might have gotten, were they still doing, what did they call it, transportation at the time? Like you commit a crime and you get sent to Australia. I don't know if that's still happening in 1912. So I don't know if maybe this guy had a less than reputable past and that's how he ended up in a penal colony.
And Australians, very well known for not at all adhering to conspiracy theories.
Well, also known not to be a real country. Catch our Australia Facts or Fiction episode with Dr. Rags. But this is a quote from this gentleman's letter. He says, quote, "When the surviving crew got to port, they were all taken aside and met by two men, one in a high position in the company. The other man was in a very high position in the government. The government man read the crew the Official Secrets Act, explaining if they told of the real reason for the sinking or the rumors of an insurance scam, they would serve a minimum of 20 years in jail and would never get a job when they got out." So, look, maybe this guy's lying. Maybe he's full of it. But this is kind of like this is the historically documented example that the authors found of someone saying, like, look, this was known among the people working at the shipyard, and this guy put it in writing and sent it. Maybe it's legit. Maybe it's not. But again, just in the aggregate here.
My recollection is, like, I think what is far more likely is that this guy either misremembered or misunderstood those instructions. If he was there, I don't know if he was on the ship or not. If he was, after the sinking and the survivors did make it back to shore, there were months or years of lawsuits that went on. Mm-hmm. And like this guy Ismi that you mentioned, I'm pretty sure he actually survived and ended up in court, and like his life was kind of destroyed after all right. of this is my vague recollection. I don't know for certain that that's true. But there were a number of crew members that testified that White Star executives had come to them and basically said, if you talk about the sinking, mm-hmm. if you cast any aspersions on the company, we will prosecute you.
So it's legit this could have happened. It just could have been referenced to something
else. Yeah, exactly. I think that they were looking at liability. They were not looking at trying to create some – yeah. I don't think that there was a conspiracy. I think it was just – trying to protect themselves from going bankrupt.
Jason, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a crypto historian. So I'm open-minded about what you're suggesting here.
Tomatoes, tomatoes.
Yeah. But like I often do, I'm starting at the least compelling and moving towards the most compelling.
Right.
So I'll concede these early points. But once I start throwing haymakers at the end,
yeah.
I mean, you're going down quicker than the Olympic. That's all I'm saying, Jason. So... you know, we mentioned JP Morgan's involvement, and JP Morgan is amongst some of the wealthy and high prior profile people who canceled their trip at the last minute. And JP Morgan's excuse was due to quote unquote ill health. Now think about that. Think about this. He was a financial investor in this project, probably the most famous person in the world. Mm-hmm. At that time.
I think that's right.
Just his presence alone on the ship was probably incredibly valuable in terms of, you know, like the price of a ticket or the class of people that you could get to book a passage and spend money on it. So, and like, what do rich people like to do? Like they like to be firsts. Like the Titanic was like the space race of the 1910s, right? I mean, these giant ocean liners. So It seems to me unlikely that someone with
But it was like Apollo 12 because the Olympic had already done this.
it seems to me it would take more than the sniffles to keep JP Morgan off a ship and out of the opportunity to be the first and to be part of something huge and titanic in scale and and historic in nature. And not only did JP Morgan pull himself off the boat, he pulled his entire family and a bunch of valuable sculptures and busts that he had placed on the ship sort of as decoration to show off his wealth or to try to dress up the Olympic, I mean, sorry, Titanic, to dress up the ship for its maiden voyage. So in and of itself, again, maybe a coincidence, but it's very interesting that both JP Morgan and his wife, who was also purported to be ill and pulled off the ship because of that illness, were seen in Paris 2 days later, out gallivanting around town and having a great time. And something that was of note, because just like we have like Musk trackers now on Twitter, like people have like, what's that kid who puts Elon Musk's plane whenever it's in the air and like tweets it out. People kept track of where JP Morgan was. Everyone was watching him.
And
he was a celebrity.
You have upwards of 110 years on this planet, and that's what you choose to do with your life.
So look, it is pretty strange. Morgan is one of the principal investors, has a lot of personal and financial stake in this, would want to be involved, pulls him and his whole family off at the last minute with no notice. This is an explanation of sickness, but we still see him out in public, seemingly doing pretty well and having a great time in Paris.
Hey, all of that seems really compelling to me, but there is another very plausible and equally compelling argument in my mind, which is, as we were talking about, White Star was not in great financial shape. JP Morgan, historically, was really well known as not somebody who backed companies that were going down. He, mm-hmm. At that point in his career, he was not a high risk, high reward kind of guy. And it's equally plausible to me that by the time like the Olympic had hit this other ship and the company was severely strapped, and JP Morgan may have just said, that's the last straw, I'm out of here.
That's plausible. No, I see that. But this all happened pretty quickly, too. And I'm not saying everything went according to plan and that this was the plan from the beginning. I think the Olympic striking the Hawk revealed the vulnerabilities of these two sister ships that had been built that people didn't know exist. And we didn't plan for it for the financial situation to get this desperate.
JP Morgan was also very well known as somebody who had a lot of attention to detail, and he was very much a micromanager. So it's also plausible to me that he was looking at these designs and had them reviewed by somebody else, and they went, this thing is not as unsinkable as they claim it is. And then the sister ship hits another ship and has a bunch of damage, and he just goes, these guys have no idea what they're doing. I'm not doing this.
Or it's equally as plausible that J.P. Morgan is also a well-documented and known ruthless businessman
he
would do anything to recoup his investment, even if it wasn't that – it's more the principle of it to him would be more meaningful than the money itself. So this sounds exactly like the kind of thing that J.P. Morgan would have gone along with, but not risk the life of his family and himself. Just saying. It's suspicious that also, he pulls out at the last minute.
No, the only thing that I'm quibbling with here at all is the idea that it was the principle and not the money, because for J.P. Morgan, I think they were one and the same.
Okay, so let's just say maybe J.P. was in on it and pulled out. Let's say J.P., totally innocuous reason, he did get the sniffles for one day and took off to Paris.
I'll go neutral on that one.
Okay, sure. Yep. Call it neutral. But now where things start to get a little bit more suspicious as we get closer in proximity in terms of time and geography to the iceberg. And this is where the SS Californian comes into play. So the SS Californian is the...
All I can hear is that Saturday Night Live skit.
Oh, which one is
Californians.
Oh, I don't know that one. We'll have to edit that in. I don't know that one. But the SS Californian is the ship that rescues a lot of the people that goes into the water and collects the lifeboats.
Oh, right. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So this is what's funny about the voyage of the SS Californian. So it was a smaller ship, so it didn't have like a huge passenger capacity. It's more of a cargo ship, right?
Yeah.
And
could pick up about, you know, 500, maybe 600 passengers, but not 2,200.
Not 2,200 comfortably, but the thing that's interesting, and I didn't know this until I did my own research, but there was a pretty significant coal shortage actually in the UK at the time the Titanic sunk. And because the Titanic and the Olympic were the biggest shows in town, they were procuring a lot of coal on top of a coal shortage, and it was making it very difficult for other ships to get the needed resources that they had to collect to be able to make the transatlantic crossing. The Californian, somehow in the midst of this coal shortage, at the exact time that the Titanic/Olympic is buying up all the coal in town, seems to scratch together enough coal for a transatlantic journey. But curiously enough, this smaller ship that, you know, presumably has spent a bunch of cash paying inflated prices for coal to be able to make the journey, doesn't book any passengers on their voyage heading from the UK to the United States. And the cargo that they're carrying is blankets, coats, and winter clothing. That's what they're going to be transporting from the UK to North America. Very, very interesting. Shortly after the Olympic/Titanic leaves port, the Californian also leaves port. And I don't know if you're familiar. You know about the oceans, right, Jason? You've seen a map before.
Like, I am familiar that there are oceans on this planet, yes.
And you're vaguely familiar that they're large spaces.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's
quite vast.
It's also, on top of all of those kind of strange dilemmas that we're building upon, then we happen into this equally as unlikely coincidence that the Olympic ends up being one of the only ships within a distance where it could quickly respond to the Titanic/Olympic if it should end up to be in distress for whatever reason, manufactured or otherwise.
Well, just very quickly, yes, the oceans are vast and there is lots of space out there. But the fact of the matter is there are shipping lanes that make that likelihood far more likely than one would guess if you just look at a map of the Atlantic Ocean and go, there's no chance that ship would have been next to the other one.
So, yeah, no, I get that. So any one of those things by themselves, sure, I'm with you. But all of those things added together, and then you start to think about it.
Well, I also lived in Florida for a very long time, and you know what you hide in cargo of, like, clothes and life rafts and, yeah, cocaine, man.
I was going to say, I was just about to say, so it was a little, what's the, like some Manchester fairy dust or.
That's right, yeah.
So look, just put yourself. Yeah,
the Californian was actually a cigarette boat.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
All right, so if we're gonna put ourselves in the minds of the conspirators here, Jason, which shouldn't be that hard, and you think about now kind of the role that the Californian is playing in this, let's talk about how we would manufacture this insurance scheme, this insurance fraud scheme, and how we'd plan it to maximize our reward. But we're like compassionate conspirators here, right? Like we want to preserve human life where we can. Like we want to perpetrate our fraud in a responsible and humanitarian way. So we set up the Titanic to strike an iceberg or to have some sort of onboard emergency. But We want to do it in a way that...
And by the Titanic, you mean the Olympic.
The Olympic. We want to do it in a way that, you know, gives us enough time to be able to evacuate all the passengers onto a ship that we know is nearby and will be able to respond before we sink, and is already outloaded with winter coats and blankets and all the comforts of home that you would need to complete the voyage to North America, which we should also point out, they were almost there, right? This was a pretty, if you were going to have to inconvenience people for moving from one ship to another and making it the rest of the way of the journey, this isn't a bad place to get in trouble. You're pretty much... you're just off the coast of Newfoundland.
Well, except for the freezing temperatures. And the lack of life rafts. And yeah.
But think about that. It's not like they couldn't count. And I know the standard argument about, hey, it would crowd up and take up deck space and it wouldn't be aesthetically pleasing for the wealthier guests. But if you know that the Californian's coming to pick everybody up and you think your ship's going to be sinking a lot more slowly, that's a good reason not to worry about all these life rafts, right? You know you're not going to need them because the Californian's going to be waiting because you've already chosen the time and the place and the method of the disaster that's going to undertake the Olympic.
Yeah, except
and the
those California design choices by. Were baked in long before the Olympic had hit the whatever the other ship was. Like
the Hawk.
The Hawk. Yeah. Like the Olympic was not outfitted with any of those life rafts. Like that design choice was made before they were really bending metal on these crafts. So in order for what you're saying to be true, they basically would have been planning to sacrifice the Olympic in place of the Titanic while they were still building the craft, which is logically incompatible with this scheme.
No, I would agree with that. I'm not saying that they were good at what they were doing. I'm not saying it was a well-executed conspiracy. I'm saying that it was a conspiracy from the beginning that went awry. So I think these inherent design flaws and the things that went wrong that contributed to this disaster being a true tragedy weren't part of the intended fabric of the insurance fraud scheme. So they didn't expect the ship to go down as quickly as it did. The ballast issue that you talked about with the water going over the top of the ballasts was not anticipated. And
that's true.
Yeah. So all of these things that made it a bad idea.
It fucking should have been, yeah. But it was not.
All of these things that made the almost sinking of the Olympic, the intended almost sinking or the slow motion sinking of the Olympic, were not good ideas. They were just, they were unanticipated and it wasn't part of the original conspiracy.
Again, we're running into the whole Occam's razor thing, but go ahead, keep going.
Okay, so going to Occam's razor though, Jason, I mean, this in a way is an elegantly simple explanation, at least from a motive perspective here, right? Like you have a ship that's no longer viable and too expensive to fix because of its collision with the Hawk. You have a way in a high-profile way that's so sensational that it could only be conceived of from the mind of a 1910s robber baron, and that it would almost be beyond suspicion because it would be perceived as being so disastrous. And you have an opportunity to basically trash your asset that's lost its value, recoup the value of it as if it was the ship that was still in good shape, the Titanic, and have no one the wiser. You offload your invaluable asset, you collect the insurance money, you basically pull out a dividend from your investment, and you still have the largest, most luxurious, most famous ocean liner in the world to go out and turn out profits for you.
Yeah, but you still require a crew that will actually steer a craft with civilian passengers on it into an iceberg.
You don't need a crew, you just need a captain.
No, you'd need a crew as well because there were people spotting.
Okay, so I'm going to get to, I don't want to do it yet, but I do have one potential explanation for this. If the crew needed to either be involved, bribed, deceived, distracted, there is one individual, I think, who could have facilitated any one of those pathways. But we'll get to her. Place a bookmark on that for me, Jason. We'll get there. But I just want to make sure. I want to make sure we're all together here on this timeline that, you know, we have a motive. We have opportunity. And we have a pile of circumstantial evidence so far. So in the court of maritime law, we're talking international law of the sea here.
We have a really shaky motive because I don't think that the indemnification would actually...
Money is the most secure of all motives, Jason. Money and love, baby.
No, I agree with that. But I doubt seriously that they're in... Again, I would have to go back and do my own research. But I doubt that their indemnification was going to pay them... Like, You sink the ship. You have to do something with all of the passengers. All of them are going to sue. The people at the dock that were expecting the ship to show up, you know, the cargo that was on the ship, like all of these people are going to sue you. On top of that, you're going to be in lawsuits for years. You're already in a bunch of lawsuits from the other aspects of this company. And now you only have one ship expecting the income of two ships. Insurance is not going to pay for all of that. It might recoup the damages that you get from hitting the Hawk, but it's not going to recoup all of the other things that you're up against.
Okay, so if money was the only motivating factor, you might be right. There is a, should we call it a sister theory to this theory that runs parallel to what we're talking about. And maybe this could shine some extra light here into the depths of the Marianas where we're trying to uncover the truth. And, you know, there might have been things associated with the sinking of the Olympic/Titanic that were more valuable than money to J.P. Morgan. It is curious. You said some.
I think we've already established that that's not true.
we made the point that at least one of, I don't know about the other two, of the principal investors in the venture, who were also extremely wealthy men, did actually board the ship, and that there were other extremely wealthy individuals, some of the richest people in the world, on the ship. So what if J.P. Morgan looks at this and says, "Hey, this is a way that not only can I clear some of this legal obligation and this debt that I've incurred from this strike with the Hawk and get a little insurance payout for this conundrum that I found myself in, but also eliminate some of my most fierce competitors, clear the field of the other Robin Barons, get all these other billionaires off the chessboard and allow J.P. Morgan. Now the field's wide open. You have all these businesses, all of this enterprise with all of a sudden no one at the helm of their respective industries. And it would have allowed J.P. Morgan to move in and take them over. And look, I didn't want to bring this one into the episode, but this is a theory that's even more popular, even more subscribed to amongst, you know, the quality of people who are a subscriber to this podcast, than the insurance fraud theory is that J.P. Morgan's actually behind this just to eliminate the competition. So I'm just saying, you know, maybe the quote unquote hard mathematics don't add up, but if you could eliminate the competition.
One of the richest, most successful people in the entire history of the United States was also a massive serial killer.
I don't find those two things to be mutually exclusive.
I can't say one way or the other. That said, this is a provable theory. Right? I don't know what those rich people did, the ones who were on the Titanic. I don't know where they made their money. Mm-hmm. And if that was the case, after they all died, you would easily be able to look at J.P. Morgan and watch him go into those industries, take over those businesses, do whatever the hell it is that these conspiracies seem to think that he was doing. I've never heard that before. And I've studied a whole lot of history.
Well, maybe it's because it didn't go exactly according to his plan and he felt like it was too risky then, right? It became too high profile.
Right, suddenly he has morals.
Yeah, right? There's too much of a spotlight on it. So look, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying, like, you know, we just planted another seed of the doubt. I think I've peeled off one more juror.
I find that, again,
we're closer and closer to a hung jury.
I personally find that really implausible, but it is actually provable. So I, like, if somebody wants to go and do the research, I would bet 99% that this is not the case.
Send us your thoughts. We'll drop it in. We'll add some guest commentary on this one. Just a couple other pieces of this is more of hard evidence, but one other thing that the subscribers of this theory point to is that the quote unquote Olympic was taken out of service in 1935, and part of the wood paneling and kind of other parts of the ship were taken and used for kind of decoration or like built into the infrastructure of a place called the White Swan Hotel in the United Kingdom. And you can go today to the White Swan. You can see this stuff. I think it's part of their main staircase and on the wall when you walk in. But the paneling shows numbers on the frame, and that paneling has the frame number on it, 401. And that was the number given to the Titanic when it was being built in Belfast, Ireland. However, if that paneling had really been from the Olympic, the paneling would have actually read 400, not 401. The designation for the Olympic was 400, and the designation for the Titanic was 401. So this proves that this could provide some proof that, look, the ships were switched. Or how did you end up with paneling and parts of the ship that had the designated manufacturing stamp of the Titanic on a ship that was supposedly the Olympic, that, you know, existed long enough and continued to sail, long enough that it was decommissioned, scrapped down, and put into a hotel staircase, which is a great way place to hide the evidence. I mean, let's be honest.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. Like, again, the likelihood that a few pieces that were made for two identical ships, like the idea that because those two might have been transposed, therefore the entire ship was transposed. I don't find that compelling at all. I've been involved in enough sort of
conspiracies.
One-off design projects where you've got test articles and you've got the actual thing that you're building, or you've got two or three things that you're building and a test article. Like, the number of times that something breaks on something that you're supposed to be testing, or you're supposed to, like, and you just take apart from another thing in order to keep yourself on schedule, that happens so frequently. And in, like, these days with systems engineering, those changes are meticulously recorded. But in 1912, you didn't have systems engineering. So the idea that, like, they needed that piece one day and the piece wasn't done for the ship that was supposed to go first, but the other piece was further ahead, and you just go, well, fuck it, let's just use that. That makes perfect sense to me.
Okay, well, I've said it before, Jason, and I'll say it again. If it was just the paneling, or if it was just the Californian, or if it was just J.P. Morgan,
right,
or just
but,
any one of these other
but
reasons.
None of these things are even remotely related. These are just completely circumstantial things that are completely explainable in the course of normal everyday events that happen on every other, every ship that was being built at that time ran into these exact same things.
So what I think I'm hearing you saying, Jason, is that there... the probability of the explanation being innocuous is greater than the probability of the explanation being the foundation for this conspiracy.
By a wide margin.
Okay. So, Jason, what would you say the odds are of any one single person being on the, let's call it the Titanic, if we'll be respectful of your viewpoint here, we'll call it the Titanic, of any one person being on the Titanic when it sank and escaping and surviving.
Right.
Another HMS ship that was owned by the White Star Line that sunk and led to a large insurance payout and also survived the sinking of that ship. And, oh, the same person also being on the Olympic when it collided with the Hawk and they inexplicably survived. What do you think the odds are of the same person being on all three of those ships in all three instances and surviving all three? Probably pretty low.
Well, I don't know, but this is a provable thing, right? Like, from a mathematical standpoint, I don't know what the tickets cost for these ships. I don't know who this person was. I don't know what class they were staying in. I don't, like, because if you start talking about this being a member of the upper class, then that number, like the possibility that that individual would be on all three ships, that goes up a whole lot.
So it's not a guest. It's an employee of the White Star Line. And her name is Miss Violet Jessup. And I don't know a lot about Miss Jessup. I'm sure her ancestors are subscribers to the podcast, so I don't want to defame her
cast
reputation.
Aspersions, as
yeah,
it were.
I don't want to speak ill of the Jessup line. I'm sure they're fine people on both sides, but I do find it curious, and I have absolutely no evidence to back this up. I'll preface it by saying this, but I just have a feeling that there might be more than to Miss Jessup than meets the eye here, and. You made the point earlier that, how is it that the whole crew was in on it, or the additional people who were lookouts who had to also be asleep on the job or drop the ball for the captain to not be solely responsible for the collision with the iceberg. And I just find it curious that there's someone who, appears to have the elements of an agent of disaster on all three. All three of these voyages, when the strike happens with the Hawk, when the Britannic goes down.
You're not going to cast aspersions, but an agent of disaster.
and when the Titanic / Olympic strikes the iceberg, if you were going to engineer it, you'd have to have an inside man, or better yet, an inside lady, on the job who could make sure that all the dominoes, so far as you could control them, not talking about the life rafts and the watertight seals here, to make sure that all the dominoes fell in the proper disastrous order to ensure the best outcome for your insurance fraud conspiracy. And I just find it curious that Violet Jessup is at all three of these incidents. Just saying. I'm just throwing it out there. It's weird, Jason. It sets my spidey sense off.
Okay. So having one person that happens to be on three very large ships working for the same company that owns these ships, that's odd, but not very compelling. So I assume that you have more evidence here that you're going to
bring. No, just a feeling.
Just a feeling. Yeah. That's it.
Let's be clear. No, but You're missing one important variable there, Jason, and it's that she was on all three ships, and all three ships met with some unfortunate incident, and in two of the instances, the ship went down, and more than half the people died, and she survived all three incidents. So she's present for all three, survives all three, and it's not like she's like an aristocrat, right? Everywhere she goes, something goes wrong. That's all I'm saying.
Maybe she's like the Typhoid Mary of ships,
right?
Like,
or maybe she's J.P. Morgan's. Like, there's got to be like some like a B-class action movie, like The Kingsman or something. But it's like J.P. Morgan is like the mastermind. There's like a Charlie Angels level thing, and Violet Jessup is like the original angel, and she's just out there committing insurance fraud for J.P. Morgan, just helping him proliferate his wealth, making it happen.
Again, is it likely? Of course not. But does it happen? Yeah. I mean, there have been, you know, flight attendants on aircraft that have have been on multiple aircraft that have crashed and survived. Like, I don't blame them for the aircraft crash. The fact that they're on board does not put them under suspicion to me. And if that's all you're bringing to me is that she was on three ships that crashed, man, maybe her luck just really sucked. That's not...
All right, it's possible. That's the. I got a couple other questions I want to ask you, but that's the last one on this this conspiracy specifically. There's some other fishy things with the Titanic I want to bring up, but I.
Yeah, well, I want to go one further on this woman, Jessup.
Okay.
What did she do on these ships? Like, was she in a position?
She was a stewardess.
Yeah. So
the perfect cover
to do what?
Access to all parts of the ship. Able to move between all three decks, all classes of passengers without being noticed. Wallpaper in the background. I don't know. I bet you if we looked up her relatives today, we found some photos of her.
I bet you
she was shockingly attractive, too.
The captain of the Titanic did not go down with the ship because he ascribed to my belief about women and children.
The captain of the Titanic
first.
Did go down with the ship.
No, I thought he survived.
Oh, no. He died. Yeah. He knew he blew it, and he knew what Jessup and Morgan were going to do to him if he got on one of the lifeboats. He knew he was a dead man, so he went down with the ship.
It's been 20-plus years since I looked at all this. I thought he ended up in court for years.
Well, what I like to think happened is Jessup offed him on her way off to the last right route, so she knew she had to cover it up. So she made sure he was disposed of before she cut the last boat off the sinking ship.
I do remember testimony from crew members that the captain did take blame. Let me rephrase it. I thought it was the captain who had said that in court, but I know that there was acceptance of blame from the captain and others. As like, there's the reason we know what happened on that ship is because people ended up in court being able to testify about the events that led to the ship hitting the iceberg. Nowhere in there does it say, oh, well, you know, there's this really hot stewardess who told me to steer it into an iceberg, and J.P. Morgan was going to pay me billions of dollars. Like,
they didn't call them stewardesses then, Jason. I think they called them they were cabin maids, or I'm sure there's some
something
other
far more offensive. Yeah. Right?
I mean, it's the 1910s, Jason.
Yeah, and they call them whatever the name was and then pat them on the butt on the way out. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you got anything else on the theory itself before you make a call? And then I got some bonus content questions I want to hit you with. Stupid or not stupid, Jason, the Titanic never sank.
This just strikes me as a fairly routine conspiracy theory without any... research whatsoever, like without reading any of the stories, without knowing any of the facts about the characters that you have put forward.
You're really assuring our listeners they're getting their money's worth out of the effort that you put into the show that they listen to.
We have, you know, that was from day one, man. You know, little or no recording fidelity and even less content. But no, I just what I know about the operation of large vessels of this kind and what I remember about the history of this ship, everything that you've thrown at me, there's a much more plausible explanation for that doesn't require a conspiracy.
Okay, well, I'm going to meet you halfway, Jason. I'm going to offer a compromise.
Okay.
I will admit that in the aggregate, I'll call this theory stupid if you admit there's more to Violet Jessup than meets the eye.
Oh my God, she was a transformer?
So if you agree that Violet Jessup in some capacity was a secret agent, I'll admit that the Titanic sunk. Deal?
Sure.
Awesome. We did it, Jason. Okay, well, since we've agreed on that and cleared that up, I got two other Titanic-related questions or theories for you that I want to get your take on.
All right.
But they're not related to the historical sinking of the ship, the Titanic. They're related to the movie. So, we're obviously not going to do an episode on whether the movie was stupid or not, but there's some elements of the movie I want to get your hot take on.
Sure.
So, question number one, Jack, the protagonist, or I guess, is Kate the protagonist? I'm sorry, not Kate. What's her name in the...
Kate Winslet. Yeah, I can't remember.
She's the actress. Rose.
I've only ever seen the movie once.
Okay. Well, so Rose is the protagonist. Is Jack from the future? Is Jack a time traveler? This is a legit question that there's a ton of conversation on. So, think about this, Jason. So, Jack saves Rose from committing suicide. That's like how they meet in the movie, right? Like, this is the divergent plot point that kind of sends the story in a different direction and leads us into the main narrative of the film.
Right.
So, Jack is there at the right place at the right time to stop Rose from jumping off the ship. Now, just think about, in the timeline of the Titanic, if Rose would have jumped off the ship, what that would have meant for the fate of everyone on board. So say Rose hits the water. She's, you know, among the wealthiest on board. They certainly would have stopped to search for her. They would have diverted at least slightly temporarily, at least, what, half a day you're probably going to lose.
Yeah.
Like, at least trying to recover a body for a person of the bourgeoisie, of the elite class.
Right.
So any kind of deviation, any kind of change from your current course, you probably miss the iceberg, right? Like, what are the odds that you collide with the iceberg? Like, it's like we said now in like a bunch of episodes, like if you run it 100 times, like it's going to happen. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's highly unlikely, but if you do it enough times, it's going to happen. But one little standard deviation and, you know, everyone gets to New York safely.
Yeah.
So there are implications for Rose not hitting the water.
It's a counterfactual.
It's a counterfactual. It's counterfactual. There are implications for Rose hitting the water, and Jack just seems to be in the right place at the right time. That's pretty thin, but let's dig a little deeper. So let's just look at the evidence. In the beginning of the movie, this opening scene, it's him having to play poker, but bet his possessions in order to win the tickets he needs to get onto the ship. One of the things that we've talked about in time travel is that it's harder to bring, well, when I say we talked about it, what I really mean is we've learned from the Terminator movies, is that...
That's exactly where I was going. Like, you had me a minute ago with all of this. I was like, well, James Cameron did
Terminator, right?
This. Right.
There's a continuity
at this point,
here.
I'm 100% certain that Rose was John Connor's mother.
Right. So we have, I was definitely going to make this connection. Like, you could say one of the greatest time travel stories of all time, Terminator.
Yeah.
James Cameron is the director. So we know that if Jack in the Cameron universe did travel from the future to the Titanic timeline, he wouldn't be able to bring any physical possessions with him, which means no money,
right.
Which means he'd have to get his hands on whatever he could and win his ticket in a poker game. So that's how he gets on the boat in the first place. But then when he's talking to Rose, he mentions a place, Lake Wissota, where he's from in Wisconsin. She says, like, where are you from? And he talks about the story, how he fell through the ice at Lake Wissota and, like, he hit the water and it was so cold. And it's one of the stories that really sticks out to you and is foreshadowing what's going to happen when they hit the water.
Right.
The interesting thing about Lake Wissota is that Lake Wissota is a man-made lake that wasn't created until 1917.
Whoops.
After the Titanic, 5 years after the Titanic sunk. So how would Jack know about Lake Wissota? Interesting, right?
Yeah, whoever the continuity director was on that completely lost the ball on that one.
Yeah. And then, you know, we can chalk this one up to Hollywood, but just look at his appearance. Jack's haircut is completely out of place for the era. So his physical...
nobody had product like that back
then. That's what I'm talking about. So, you know, there's something
and
about...
boys didn't wear lipstick in the
20s. Right. No eyeliner, like didn't roll their eyelashes, no nothing. So Jack's looking pretty suspicious. And then as they begin to develop their romance and fall in love, Jack claims that when they get to North America, he's going to take Rose on a roller coaster on the Santa Monica Pier. The Santa Monica Pier wouldn't be built until 1916, even later than the dredging of Lake Wissota. So how did Jack have all this knowledge of these future places? Also, if you pay close attention, you know, Jack smokes cigarettes throughout the film. He even authors Rose one.
Right.
If you look closely at all those cigarettes, they have filters. Very interesting.
Yeah,
no filtered
there were no
cigarettes
filters.
In the vest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
it's just like the conspiracy theory of the Olympic here. We're just building.
My recollection is filters and cigarettes didn't come until much later than the roller coaster.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just all of these interesting things. And then you start to think about, and I guess I want to step away from Jack as a time traveler for a second. I want to ask you
Well, that's too bad because I'm all in on this.
No, I want to ask you a different question and then come back to the time traveler question and wrap it all together. The second definitive and like epic question that's asked of the Titanic film, and there are whole like websites dedicated to this. It's crazy. Is couldn't they both fit on the door?
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah. That's where I thought you were going earlier.
Yeah.
But that's the thing is these two like wrapped together. If he had been a human, of course they could have. But if he was a Terminator, way too heavy. He immediately would have sank.
So this question of could they both fit on the door? Because that's like a massive door in the film.
Oh, yeah,
right? It's huge. It's like a flotation device.
Yes.
And so people have been debating this since the movie came out. So Mythbusters took it up. And they basically got a replica of the door. Like they figured it out like through their connections in Hollywood ever. Got an exact replica in the door. And like Jamie and whatever the other guy is, they basically get into a pool and they figure out how to get on the door and float together. It takes them about 10 minutes to figure it out, right? And they're not even in a life or death situation.
Right.
And they figure out, and they're two grown men.
Right.
Figure out how to fit on this door and survive.
Which makes it far more dicey, like from a social perspective, than getting on the door with your girlfriend.
Right. Yeah. So, especially in 1912.
Right.
So they get this figured out, and it's just like, it's one of those things where it's like, he tries once, he kind of puts like a half-hearted effort in it, falls back off the door, and just gives up and hangs there knowing he's going to die.
Right.
So
it's Jamie and Adam, by the way.
Jamie and Adam. All right. So the first question I want to ask before I bring us back to time travel is stupid or not stupid, Jason? They both could have fit on the door, realistically, right?
That is not stupid at all. Yes, right. They absolutely could have.
Okay. So you have to ask yourself, then why didn't Jack try to get on the door? I mean, Leo Decap, as Dr. TJ would call him at that time, probably what, weighed all of 90 pounds soaking wet like he was. So why didn't he try harder? And I think it's because, Jason, he'd accomplished his mission.
Right.
He went back to the moment in time that stopped Rose from jumping off the Titanic, which diverted the timeline to a point where the Titanic hit an iceberg and altered history in a very real way based off of the roster of people that were on the ship.
So now, basically he saved one person in order to kill 1,500.
Or, you know, like pre-Hitler is on the Titanic, or the person like who's going to rise.
Well, that worked out well.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe one of the, this is morbid, I guess, but maybe one of the kids who ends up drowning in the Titanic grows up to be like North America Hitler at the same time Hitler comes to power in the 40s.
Meta Hitler, right?
Yeah, meta Hitler, right? Like there, something happens in the James Cameron verse. Something happens in the future where someone does something that's so terrible in the future that you need to send somebody back in the past to, like, maybe they get to the point where they develop a simulation, right? Where you can go back and find all of the variables and all of the things where you can find the one divergent point that could stop the most terrible thing from happening. And it was Rose jumping off the Titanic.
Yeah, I think this is the plot of Time Cop.
Yeah, that's right. So Jack is Time Cop. Jack had to go back in time to make sure that Rose didn't jump off the boat, to ensure the Titanic hit the iceberg, to divert whatever terrible disaster and maledic episode that was going to plague humanity and be the downfall of our civilization in the future by killing whoever needed to die on the Titanic.
See, I love this idea. I genuinely do.
Like, because it's continuity between all Cameron's work.
It does that. It makes the story far more interesting. Like, I would actually enjoy this movie much more if that were the case. But the fact of the matter is, LDC, as I call him, would never have taken sloppy seconds.
You call Leo Decap LDC?
We would never have taken sloppy seconds from Jean-Claude Van Damme from Time Cop. So I just find that implausible.
Okay, so stupid or not stupid, Jason, Jack was a time traveler who deliberately chose not to fit on the door because his mission was completed.
Yeah, I don't think that's stupid at all. I find that like the most compelling thing that you've brought to me like in 36 episodes of this show.
Okay, well, I think what everyone needs to do is kind of a series of actions here. You need to like, you need to follow, you need to share this episode with all your friends, and then you need to turn off this podcast and go watch Titanic, but through the lens of James Cameron's time travel plotline.
That's right.
Yep. You're welcome. Thank us later. Until next time.